The Bain Free Radio Hour.
Hello and welcome to the Bain Free Radio Hour. Today we bring you part two of Griffin Barber's interview of Larry Correa, Jason Cordova, Mike Massa, Marisa Wolfe, and Casey Azell to discuss the much-anticipated anthology Monster Hunter Files Volume 2. After that, we'll have more One Jump Ahead by Mark L. Van Name, Part 52.
Wow. And then we also had Melissa Olthoff.
Mm-hmm.
What was the story called? I can't remember. But it was based in like central Indiana. I can't remember the name of the story now.
I didn't grab my copy first. Okay, her story is excellent.
Yeah,
it's a good story.
Incredibly good. Yeah,
like it's new hunters, so it's young. It's like these young people, but they actually come from a family background of it, so they're not completely unaware. And one of them has a fey connection. Actually kind of an interest story, but it's also a dark story. It's one of the darker ones in there. It's got a gut punch. And I will say that she didn't shy away from that gut punch either. I was actually really impressed. It was
Eyes Like Mine.
That's it. Yeah, I was like, I know the eyes.
Yeah.
I was surprised because, it was a good story, and I was reading through it. And I was like, I was enjoying the story. And actually, my edits on it were fairly small, too. I think me and Jason, my edits were just like a couple little in-universe things. Mm-hmm. Like just minor. And then, but we got to the end of the story, and I was like, wow, okay. She went there, and that was, but you know what though? So Monster Hunter, part of the Monster Hunter universe is the good guys get their butts kicked all the time, and they take hits, they take losses. And this is not one of those shiny, happy, fun universes where everybody always, all the good guys always win. I mean, sometimes good guys lose. And it was good. It was a very good story. I really liked that one.
Yeah, that was one of the things that may have been noticed by some of our watchers or listeners is that Marisa and Casey both knew what we were talking about with Melissa's story because
read that one early.
They're all part of the Feral Ladies at Bain, and their author group is coming and serving each other, helping each other out, and just getting everything together. So I'm sure that they probably read each other's stories going into this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's
we did.
A lot of talent. It's a good talent pool right there.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. No, I had a very similar reaction upon reading Melissa's story that I was just like, oh damn. Okay.
Yeah.
All right then. You know,
like it's good. It's a good story. It's well written. So, and then all of a sudden it's like, bam. It's like,
it elevates it, right? The emotional piece of it just really elevates the entirety of the story.
It's like, oh, she ain't chickening out.
Mm-mm. That, okay,
I think
so
the only thing I asked her to change was the city it was based in. I was like, no, that city's got too many people. You need a smaller rundown Indiana town. Hold up. Let me hit a look for you one.
We got it.
Yeah.
Let's see. I should have, and I was dumb. I sat down without grabbing.
Mine is like right outside my reach.
You're like, it's so close.
Yeah. I always do that with anthologies. Brad Torgerson is one of the returning authors from the first one. And so he had a really popular story in the first one called The Bride, which was the Bride of Frankenstein, but it was from the perspective of Benjamin Franklin. And this one, he does it from the perspective of Teddy Roosevelt, who we established had done some monster hunting early on.
Yeah. In San Juan.
So, like, and I had referred to that in the series, but we never told the story. So we actually get some Teddy Roosevelt monster hunter action there. And then another one that was referred to a lot in the series is Decision Week and the events of that. And I used Rob Hampson. I actually used Hampson's neurological demon bindings. So Rob is a real life scientist who is now a writer. And so he was one of the guys I used for information over the years. Like anytime I needed any sort of brain information, I would call Rob and ask him questions. And so I referred to this one thing in the series as Hampson's neurobiological demon binding. And I mentioned it as a line in one of the books, and he wanted to write the story of what actually happened in the 1940s. And actually I liked his, the thing I liked about it, about that was fun was it had a almost Lovecraftian vibe in the, like the way Lovecraft stories are usually like there's the
I didn't feel like it
narrator.
was almost. I felt the Lovecraft.
Very,
Yeah. Yeah, so there's a narrator telling you at the series of events. So there's like that like level of detachment of the narrator, even though horrible things are happening to the narrator. And so it had that. It was a good story. Now we did one edit on that with me and Jason. We had to have Rob change the ending. But it wasn't like a huge thing. It was just more of like to fit in with the existing events and what I've got going on in the next two books. To just kind of like have that squared up.
Cool.
That's the bad thing about turning all these really smart people loose, though, is they're all going to do different creative things. But the hard thing for me is like I got to go like, oh, that's cool,
but
it doesn't work.
Yeah, that's going to screw up this, and this,
and things that they're just not going to be aware of.
Yeah.
Now stuff does slip through, and we've had that slip through in other books and other because once you expand a universe, you have multiple people working in it. You're inevitably going to have people stepping on each other's toes. It's just going to happen. There's going to be something I missed because I am a fallible man, and I'm one dude with a brain that is old, and I will screw stuff up, and people be like, "Well, in book three, so and so said this, but in book seven, so and so said this. So which is it?" And I'm like,
well, that's where you get to say, well, you know, Owen is not the best memory. How many TBIs has Hatman had?
So many TBIs.
Right. That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Or magic healing magic has its limitations.
That's right. Yeah. As Tripp said, you collect TBIs like I collect Pokemon cards.
Nice.
And yeah, so I'm just going to blame it on Owen. Owen just, he got that one wrong. And there you go. Yeah, it's not that I got it wrong.
Not you, yeah.
Well, that's one of the fun things about it, right? Is in dialogue, people make mistakes. They lie.
Yeah.
They just want to shut the other person up, so they say a certain thing, and then we move on, right? Yep.
And it's not that I'm a couple million words into a series and I can't remember it all.
And then we had one of the returning stories as well, the combat exorcist, Steve Diamond.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this is a great story. And I actually feel bad. I was with Steve last night. We carpooled down to Jim's book signing. And, oh, dude, that was a good story.
That was a good story.
That's a good story. So I already had the character Gutierrez he's a knight, basically. He's an exorcist for the Catholic Church. And so Gutierrez was already in the series. And in the last Monster Hunter file, Steve introduced a character named Fideli, who has some arcane backstory, if you will. And so this continues the adventure, the buddy cop of Gutierrez and Fideli, Catholic exorcist warrior priests. And yeah, so it's the Vatican combat exorcists. And so this is another story with them. And it's Steve Diamond. So, you know, it's going to be dark. It's going to be horrific. That is Steve. That is how Steve rolls. It's a good story. It's a dang good story. And Steve's gotten better with gun stuff. I've dragged Steve along to enough gun training over the years. Mike knows, he's been there, and I've dragged Steve along, so he's actually gotten fairly proficient on his gun writing.
Speaking of shoulders, how's his doing?
I'm actually better. Like he's healed up really well. So for those who know, he had like a severe shoulder injury and had to do multiple surgeries on it, and it laid him up for the better part of a year. So, but we will be re-recording Writer Dojo again because he has a normal person job.
That's awesome.
So Writer is Dojo awesome. Is coming back.
Cool.
That's very a great podcast.
Yeah, we helped a lot of people. It turns out that we are now in the thank yous for a whole lot of debut novels.
That's really cool.
It's actually really neat.
And if you look at the lineup of people interviewed on Writer Dojo, the lineup of the anthologies, a lot of them line up.
I believe I've had most of you on, not all of you. We got to get Marissa one of these days. Yes. But yeah, and in fact, we had Mike Massa, but that was the lost episode. That was the one episode that, whatever reason, the file didn't
catch.
Yeah. We got a couple
it
with Jason.
It couldn't withstand charisma of this magnitude.
That's right.
It was great too. It was a great episode.
It was a good episode.
About using history, like real history tied in with fiction.
I gotta tell you, when when 6'6" Larry Correa and dark humor Steve Diamond says, "Hey, Mike, come to our hotel room. We want to make a little video." First, you go, "Well."
Can confirm, having had that same question asked to me.
Can only be better. Can only get better.
I was like, "I'll come, but can I bring Griffin with me?"
Look how stupid I am. I'm like, okay.
True story. Many, like a thousand years ago when I was first starting out, I was nominated for this award called the Campbell, which they don't have anymore because it was racist. So I was nominated for this award for Best New Author. And I went to the award show for it, and we were at the hotel. And I was with a group of other writers, and I was with Steve, and I was with a couple other writers, and this other guy named Dan, who's taller than I am. Dan's a very big man, who was also willing to throw hands. I discovered at a Disturbed concert. He's a good
nice.
Dude. So we're at the hotel, and one of the authors I'm up against for this award is Saladin Ahmed, who's this little tiny guy, right? He's a very small guy, and so. Me and my crew are actually we're leaving this one game and we're going to another Dungeons and Dragons game. That's how awesome we are, right? And so we're going down the hallway, and there's like six of us, and half of us are my size, right? And we're going down the hall, and we go to the elevator, and the elevator door opens, and there's one guy inside, and it's Saladin, and he's standing there, right? This little guy, and so me and all my big people go into the elevator, and he's like completely surrounded, and we just had this moment, and he's a very nice guy. And we had this moment where all these giant guys are looking at him, and I'm up against him for an award tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And I go, "Hey, we're going, this is in Reno, Nevada. I go, "Hey, we're going out to the desert. You want to see our tarp and shovel collection?"
You didn't.
And it was like this. And then we all started laughing because it was just this ridiculous moment of like bizarre conflux, you know? And, yeah, it was fun. We all laughed and it was funny, but yeah, it's like, yeah, I don't know. You know, it's like, you want to see our tarp and shovel? Oh. It's in the back of our van. We're going out to the desert.
That'd be great.
Yikes.
It's a rental van. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. No follow up questions.
Yeah, I pay extra for the full insurance. We could take the van out to the desert. It's fine.
Brought our own cleaning supplies.
Yeah, no, so shout out to Dan Smythe, who is a literal rocket scientist, but he's 6'6".
That's awesome.
And he, like I said, he will throw hands. We were at a Disturbed concert, and we were leaving the concert, and it was me and him and Josh Hill, who's a former cop and still has cop brain, and so Griff will appreciate this. We're walking along with my son, who's 6'6", and he was Johnny Football Hero, and this drunk dude comes out of nowhere and grabs my son. Just grabs him like weird. It was way weird. He just runs up and grabs my son and like starts doing this. So me, it flipped my dad's switch. It flipped Dan's dad's switch. And we both just went to like, you know,
yeah.
And we just like, you know, moved over to like whoop this guy's ass. Josh's cop brain flipped and Josh went around behind the guy. So all of a sudden it was like three dudes converging on this guy that was shaking my 6'6" son. And Steve got his camera out.
Nice.
And turned it sideways even. And then all of a sudden the drunk guy's friend saw this occurring and he's like, "No, no, 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 no." And he jumps and he's like, he doesn't mean it. He's drunk. And the drunk guy had no idea that he almost got like just completely obliterated, like 700 pounds of guy.
Yeah. I didn't know great whites ran around and
oh my gosh. I do love it. Like, so my group of friends that were there, 75% of us were ready to fight, and Steve went to film it.
I love it.
Like, and I'm not even joking.
That guy.
He knows his role, right?
That's not even a joke. I'm not even exaggerating. He literally just goes, "Oh, they're going to fight this guy."
Well, the thing for me, I can imagine him smiling while he does it too. Like,
yeah, yeah. He knows his role.
For those of you that know him, you know how on brand this is.
Yes.
He's not going to engage in fisticuffs like a mere barbarian. He's going to monetize.
It's a horror show, but not for me.
Oh, my gosh. And so I gained a lot. I just knew Dan. He was a nice guy. I knew he was a rocket scientist. But I wasn't aware he was like one of those Wild Bill Donovan OSS kind of, you know, what's the ideal OSS agent? Is a PhD who can win a bar fight?
Yeah.
Shout out to Dan Smythe right there. So, Dan, if you're watching this.
So one thing I wanted to mention, I've been watching it. They're looking at it in the background here is Mike's got some stuff in the background. You were mentioning Dungeons and Dragons earlier. And I was just seeing that he's got the Monster Hunter board game back there, which
Oh,
is
nice.
amazing. I know people, I know. Tabletop role player, et cetera. But wanted to give a mention to that too. Mike, you want to talk to us about those games? What they mean to
Well, I don't really want to open them up because we'd see way too much gray plastic, and that's my shame.
Oh.
But I've played it several times with my I've got single digit and double digit grandkids and some sons in their 20s and 30s, and we sat around and played it like around the last Christmas time and had a good time.
Oh.
Had to, some of the times the younger kids were upset that their brilliant moves couldn't be executed according to the rule set, but one day I'll get off my butt and get painting on them for sure.
Yeah, I can't say too much. I haven't painted in forever, so I'm unfortunately it's this is catching up to me.
Oh, yeah.
So the mini painting has slacked off.
Yeah, I can't do it because of my back. Like I just can't be locked in like
Yeah.
I need to be to make anything other than the
Yeah,
broadest.
because my painting desk is right there, and I'm very much like a bunch of lights, and it's all, hunched over. Well, here, I'll actually do this little, let's see if I can get this angle here, how many minis I have painted in my office.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
Oh, that's
Oh, no, that's
awesome.
only
Look at
one portion.
that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's
But
all
wait, there's
those over
all of
there.
those. That's
That's
amazing. Yeah.
the painting station. And then actually that whole half of the room has, well, that's all books right there. But yeah. So I've got about 6,000, 7,000 minis here.
That's
I
fun.
just saw somebody was advertising for their local Salvation Army, not Salvation Army. What's the for profit?
Goodwill.
That they had like 7,000 Warhammer miniatures for sale at this one particular down in your luck store.
So some guy like me died.
And his family was like, no, thank you.
And didn't have
Exactly.
any kids to eBay it.
Yep.
See, my
Exactly.
kids are going to be selling all my minis.
Yeah.
They're going to sell all like genuine Larry Correa minis long after I'm dead. They're going to do like Jesse James' mom. They kept selling Jesse James's guns for like
Yeah.
guns that weren't manufactured until after he died.
Right.
Better that than your gold teeth, right?
You gotta keep
Right,
the
yeah.
inventory up, sure. Yeah.
That's right.
I think everybody here is a gamer, right? Yeah. Aren't you guys playing D&D or something, Casey and Marisa? Or
We are.
okay.
We're in fact we're supposed to play Friday. So,
I got my first two sets of dice. I bought one and then immediately bought the second pair. I was like, nope, I need more of these. Thank you.
Yes.
Mine
This is
shiny
where
with
we
class.
go, yo, you sweet summer child.
I know, I know.
I
I mean, it was
know.
only a matter of time. You are the most dragony of people with your hoard of rocks and shells and fossils that surround you in your office. So
These
adding
things I have a
shiny click
purpose.
clack math
Yes.
rocks to that was
Oh.
not a hard stretch.
Marissa,
There's
it's like drugs, man. You start slow and next thing you know, you're gonna be buying them by you're gonna buy dice by the pound. You
Yes,
know,
that
you're gonna be
was a
buying
problem.
dice made out of dinosaur bones and dice made out of meteorites and crap, dice from the moon.
I still want dice made from the tears of my enemies, but
Ooh, yeah.
I think we've all have like some weird ass dice. I have dice from the catacombs in France.
Oh,
I
that's
got all
cool.
sorts of
Are they
weird
bone
crap.
dice?
No, they wouldn't
Oh,
do that. They were actually
I
just
was gonna say that's how a
plastic
tiny
dice
dragon
with skulls, but I had to buy it there at the gift shop. Very cool.
Awesome.
So, what are you playing now, Larry?
Currently, my game group's been playing a homebrew system invented by Pat Tracy, which is a D6 dice a D6 system. And we're doing basically like Neolithic to Bronze Age, like cavemen versus Bronze Age people.
Oh,
So I'm
that
playing a
sounds
caveman
fun.
paladin, basically,
Nice.
right
Cool.
now. Yeah.
Nice.
And Jason, are you playing anything?
So I've got a group of guys, Jacob Hollow, Jamie Ibsen, and Tom Pope. We actually do Helldivers 2 about 3 to 4 times a week, and that's our game addiction right now. We'll play for 2 hours, we'll do a bunch of drops, we'll try not to kill each other while laughing our asses off,
Nice.
And Casey and Marisa, you're basically D&D is the only one
Yeah.
you're doing. Yeah.
We're doing that, and then my I I coerced my husband into starting a Cyberpunk 2077 playthrough so I could watch him play it because
Yeah, it's
it's
so
fun to
pretty.
watch.
Yeah, that's a fun game.
But the problem is that I've already played it through, so I'm a little bossy sometimes. And sometimes he
Don't do
doesn't do it
that.
right.
Is he looking at you going, side quest, Casey, shut
Is he all like, am I
He's
allowed to do the romance case or am I allowed to do the romance subplots?
No, he it was kind of funny because my husband is one of these guys that like he always plays a female character for whatever reason, right? And so the romance options in that game, if you as you know if you've played it, are based on your character's body type. So with a female body type and voice, you have the option of romancing a dude, River Ward, or a chick whose name is Judy something or other, Alvarez, Judy Alvarez. And he's like, babe, I don't want to romance a fake dude, so we're gonna romance the girl, okay? Like, sure, babe. Whatever you
Well,
want
there's also the Militech Corpo. You can romance the Militech Corpo.
Yeah, but not permanently. That's a one night stand, and we're not about that life. We're
I
about
don't have
committed
that part.
relationships in my house.
Yeah, I can't say anything. I wound up married to Pan Am. When
Right,
I played, so
I
yeah.
did too when I played it when I played a male character, so.
I was like, I could fix her, and I did.
However, in your defense, Larry, Pan Am is almost as beautiful as your real life wife, so
Yeah,
there's a definite resemblance there.
that's true. If Bridget's watching that, I hope she is.
Oh, she is too.
Right,
Well,
well, this is
I know Griff, you're playing Blade Runner.
yeah, I'm running Blade Runner. I'm running Twilight 2000. I'm kind of doing all the things.
Yeah, you are.
I'm playing in a Delta Green game too, which has been cool for me
Oh, I
because
love
I love
Delta
Delta Green.
Green.
Griff has run
Arc
Delta, a
Raiders.
couple Delta Greens for me.
Yeah, that was the other thing where Mike and I got Mike into Arc Raiders the other night, and
I play Arc Raiders.
yeah, it's a lot of fun.
That's a fun game.
That is.
Yeah, I've been enjoying. I'm just a little. I'm a little pack rat.
Yep. Yeah, it's everybody's juice right now, but it's boy, is it good fun. I like the being able to team up into small teams, et cetera. So it's been a lot of fun. I
We
the
did
problem.
a stream one night 'cause I was playing DMZ really, really, really hardcore, and I got really, really good at it. Like, I got top tier level good at DMZ, Call of
Nice.
Duty DMZ. And we did a stream one night with the authors. It was me, Walt Robillard, and Nick Cole. And at the end of the night, we played for a few hours. At the end of the night, Nick had two kills, Walt had five kills, and I had 27 kills. And I guess from the perspective of the people watching, like this 4 hour stream was just Larry, like, no, don't this way. No, don't go there. Don't stand there. Stand over here. Watch down that hall. Do this, and because yeah, it was.
So
They're great guys, but I was pretty fanatical about this game, like you
That's
know. So
awesome.
yeah,
That's awesome.
Mike is carefully drinking rather than saying what exactly Griffin does during the session.
Oh.
So Mike is looking at the map, right? He's like, okay, so we can go over here, we can go over there, and I'm like, I marked it, and I start moving out, like I'm going. He's like, where'd you go?
Well, yeah, I'm hiding in the bushes. So I'm like a level three character, and Griff and his friends are like in the 40s and 50s. So the
So you
enemies
got
scale
nothing.
appropriately, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm
You're like their
surviving by
kid. You're like
discretion,
their
and they're like
5-year-old kid that
blasting
they brought
everything in
along.
sight.
You're in there with your little kitty free loadout, know nothing, and you run all slow and have no stamina.
He literally has a pew
Pew-pew.
pew.
Yeah.
Here's your kettle and one frag grenade.
Yeah, I'm the pan man, right? And then we see a big bad guy, and Griffin's friend says, oh, I'm going to call an orbital strike. I'm like, how?
Yeah, not quite, but yeah, we've been having fun. But I've literally annoyed him like 7 or 8 times in the game. Like, where the hell did you go? Like, I went to where we're going.
I don't.
That's
Oh, you
funny.
haven't memorized every single map yet? Level
I
four?
know.
Oh,
Unacceptable.
yeah. My biggest thing is in those games that my Twitch speed is so slow. Like, I get owned by these 14-year-old kids.
I still beat up the 14-year-olds, I swear on it. Yeah.
Yeah,
I still got cod, I still got cod reflexes.
Yeah, good for you. Well, again, we've gone rather far afield, but I think.
Well, yeah, we wrote a book.
Yeah, we wrote a book,
and it was good. You should read it. But
it's, you know, part of these things, this thing is that you know, the team play, the storytelling. These are all aspects that you are developing, and we are developing all the time when we engage in these games, right?
Yeah.
Especially any kind of role-playing game is where you're, you know, you're engaged in multiple perspective storytelling, and that is huge. And it's a useful skill, I think, to have. And it certainly exercises the brain to kind of try and put your feet in somebody else's shoes and try and figure out what that's like. I know for me personally, it's been a huge driver of my any kind of whatever kind of career I've had literary wise. It's been because of that, like in writing, it's because I've been driven to tell stories, etc. And I think that might be true for all of us, you know, to one degree or another.
It's that, but it's also, for me at least, gaming is like a form of self-care for my creative brain. I've said this a bunch of times, but it's like, you know how high level athletes will do, like, you know, power lifters, or they'll take their rest days, but they will do active rest where they'll do like yoga or, you know, light cardio or something like that on that day.
Yeah,
that's what gaming does for my creative brain, because it still exercises the creative storytelling part of my brain, but in a different way. So it's like a massage. It's one of the things that it's one of my go-tos when I'm starting to feel like burnt out on a project, is I'll take a break for a day or two and probably start another playthrough of Cyberpunk.
Or annoy your husband while he does
it. Or annoy my husband into doing so I can watch.
But that's, again, that's one of the things also that's cool about these anthologies and being able to work in somebody else's universe is to have that collective storytelling going on. Especially when it's such a cool and you know, delightful universe to explore. Like, you know, it's one of the biggest things about any kind of splat book for a game is that's setting, right? We get to explore this new setting, and it's certainly one of the things I've most enjoyed. And again, most of my success as far as my bigger books, and aside from the one that I co-authored with Casey, was in somebody else's universe, because I've been, you know, schooled since I was 10 years old, which was many decades ago, to actually, you know, make an aggregate in my head of what that universe is like, and then be able to kind of regurgitate it for an audience of five or six people you know, around the gaming table. So I think it's a fun thing to have. It's very much in the current era adjacent to writing. It's just the biggest single difference is actually putting your butt in the chair and actually writing, which not everybody can do. And certainly not everybody can come up with the original ideas that Larry has on multiple occasions, and certainly has executed in the Monster Hunter International universe. So really appreciate this this evening.
I've done it a few times.
So, hey, this has been the Bane Free Radio Hour. I hope you all can show some appreciation and love for our authors. And if you want to go around the dial here, I'll ask each of you where you'll be seen most recently, or in the time lead up to this. This will be airing in mid-February, the 20th of February and the 28th of February, 27th. So it's lead up to the book release in March. So please go ahead and give us where you'll be seen this year, if at conventions, that kind of stuff, what you have coming out as well. We'll start with you, Jason.
Oh, yeah, you would go with the one with the big list. Melissa and I have a Bronze Legion story coming out in March as well, in Jamie Ibsen's Plausibly Deniable. That's a lot of fun. We just had our first book in the series come out in January. That's To Tread Obsidian Shores. I'll be at LibertyCon, Imaginarium, and Dragon Con, and then I have some other stuff non-Bane coming out the rest of the year.
Cool. Larry?
I actually have been avoiding travel and cons. So I actually don't think I have anything scheduled currently.
Wow. Okay.
I know, right? I'm just like, oh my gosh. I got
releases,
So I got Monster Hunter Files next, and then after that I have a Academy Outcast 2 called Magic and Bullets. And then I believe 1 or 2 months after that, and then June I have American Paladin. Nice. Which is a new urban fantasy series. So I have a bunch of stuff going on. But yeah.
Very cool.
And Casey?
So I will have just gotten back from Boscone by the time this airs. So my next appearance will be LibertyCon. And then after that, potentially Lit RPG Con. I haven't heard back from them yet. And then definitely Dragon Con. I'll be an attending pro there. I also have a story, Implausibly Deniable, which is also out in March along with Monster Hunter Files. And co-wrote that story with Nick Steverson. So it's a lot of shooting and bad words in that story. In April, my second fantasy novel in the Mage Light universe comes out. It's called Blood on the Sand. And I'm so, so, so excited about that one. And right now, I think that's it. Yeah, that's all the news that's fit to print right now.
Cool. Marisa.
Yes, my story in Plausibly Deniable, also out the month right around when you're watching this, is a Cascada story, which is a universe I first brought in Larry and Casey's Down These Mean Streets noir story. So love me some sci-fi noir. This year I will be at LibertyCon and DragonCon, and that's it, because my best friend from childhood is retiring from the Air Force and my baby brother is getting married. So it's plenty of travel for the year. And speaking of shared world goodness, I will be deep in the Honorverse all year. So I probably will not go anywhere else because I have a lot to do. But next year you should come hang out because I'm going to be a mistress of ceremonies, which means I just get to do shenanigans the whole weekend. So keep an eye out for
Can't
that.
Confirm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Being a mistress of ceremonies won't take up any time at all. It'll be super relaxing.
Oh, easy. That's why it's next
afterwards.
Year.
It'll be great.
I have seen plenty of cool kids do it before me, so I'm just going to steal shamelessly from them.
I wouldn't know who you're talking about.
Yeah, no one on this call.
And you, Mike?
My next bit from Bane is coming out in the Troy Rising Anthology. I think that's May-June time frame, but correct me if I'm wrong, Griffin.
Was that this year?
I believe it is...
September.
September. There we go.
I forgot about that.
And true to form, I'm alternating like a sort of a grim, dark story, and then I go to a comedy store. So I'm writing humor in that universe. I go back and forth.
You do that.
That's awesome. Awkward. And I'll be at Liberty, which by then hopefully will be my home con, and I'll be at Dragon potentially.
Yes.
Which would also be almost local to you as well.
Ish.
Yeah. All right. Well, cool. I very much appreciate everybody coming on board. I really loved reading the stories in this anthology, and I imagine that everybody who touches it will. They will certainly enjoy picking up some new tales in the Monster Hunter International series. And thank you very much for coming on the show today, and we'll see you anon.
See you guys.
And now, as promised, one jump ahead. John Moore is a nanotech-enhanced soldier of fortune. Lobo is an AI, a living weapons and intelligence platform of enormous destructive potential. Two very dangerous wolves in a galaxy of deadly corporate and paramilitary predators. But Moore has grown weary of the killing, and just once he'd like to finish a job without leaving a trail of blood behind him. Not going to happen. Not on a pristine planet called Makin, where two gigantic corporations vie for control of the local jump gate and access to the riches of an undeveloped world. Dealing with a kidnapping and extortion scheme is only the beginning for Moore and Lobo as they work to stay one jump ahead.
This should go smoothly, I said, and all her precautions are understandable. Still, if anything happens that gives you any cause for alarm, leave immediately at maximum speed and track me from orbit. Don't hesitate. Affirmative, Lobo said, combat programming clamping down on the humor. Let's keep your innards as private as we can, I said. Hover at a meter and a half, and on my command, open a floor hatch, seal it the moment I'm clear. As Lobo lifted gently above the ground, I put on a self-heating, lightweight hooded jacket and crouched next to the section of Lobo's floor that would slide clear. Now. The same hatch I'd used for the stealthy on Floridan slid open, and I hopped out. I crouch-walked clear of Lobo, holding my arms straight out at shoulder height the entire time. The snow whipped at me, and the jacket struggled to keep up with the outside temperature. The sides of the hood extended enough past my face to form a bit of a barrier, but the cold still clawed at my skin. I counted on the jacket's IR profile to be so strong that everyone watching on any frequency would see I was approaching with caution. A doorway opened in a building, maybe 20 meters away. Someone dressed entirely in a white floor-length coat walked toward me. The person was either quite overweight or heavily padded. When it was close enough for me to see the face, I voted for heavily padded. It appeared to be Lim. "More," she said, her voice confirming her identity. "Lim?" "You're clean?" "Absolutely," I said. "All I want is to talk to you about a business opportunity. I have no weapons and no bad intentions."
"What about your PCAV?
"I own it, so I use it, but in this case only for transportation." "If it acts up at all," she said, "you won't live long enough to finish a sentence. We won't be anywhere that there won't be multiple sights on you." "Understood. As long as they can't hear our conversation, we'll be fine."
"That sort of business?"
I nodded. "Of course."
"Fair enough," she said. "Follow me."
We returned to the building she'd exited and walked straight into summer. The space on the other side so overheated I couldn't get the jacket off fast enough. The building was a hangar, currently empty save for a small table and two chairs in the center of its permacrete floor. Pockmarks and scorched streaks adorned its sides and rear light gray walls. The scent of fuel and oil hung in the warm air. When Lim wasn't using it to meet old comrades, this was a working maintenance facility. The four pairs of guards occupying stations in its black girder rafters were clearly Lim's additions to its standard equipment. When I pointed up at them, she smiled. "Why all the security?" I asked. Lim motioned to the chairs, and I followed her over, jacket in hand. She raised a gloved hand and ticked off reasons as she walked in front of me.
"You ask for a meeting and won't say why. You arrive in a PCAV. We were never tight, and," she chuckled, "my people see so little action that I figured any excuse for a serious drill was worth taking. I made them think you are one seriously lethal ex-soldier."
She motioned me to sit, took off her coat, and turned to face me. To the same extraordinary degree that Earl had stayed as he had been, Lim had changed. Even the standard-issue winter white fatigues couldn't conceal the modifications to her body. When I'd last seen Lim, she'd been a little taller than most women and boyish, with close-cropped black hair sitting atop a wiry body you'd only realize was female if you saw it naked. This Lim was more gorgeous and astonishingly built than 90% of the women I'd ever seen in broadcasts, with large breasts over an obviously flat stomach and enough muscle mass that her uniform bulged at the arms and legs as she moved. She was taller, too, easily as tall as Earl. Where before Lim had shown signs of the mongrel stock from which almost all of humanity has grown, now her body glowed with trendy Asian chic, the folds of her eyelids perfect, the eyes themselves almost black, her lips full and wide, her skin tone an incandescent, perfectly consistent, mellow golden hue. Her hair was still the flawless black of starless space, but now she wore it longer, a bit below shoulder length and in a ponytail.
"You can close your mouth now," she said, laughing.
"I apologize," I said. "It's simply that you're amazing. I take it you've made a few mods."
"More than a few, and all from the best clinics I could find. Everything's organic, pure gene-driven work, nothing surgical." She studied me for a moment. "I can't say I ever bothered to look at you all that closely, but you don't seem any older. Had some work done yourself?"
One of the benefits of the combination of the changes Jenny made to me and the nanomachines the agro-scientists melded with my cells is that I never appear to have physically aged past my early 20s. As long as I move around periodically, today's anti-aging techniques make me no different from anyone else. Lim was more observant than she was suggesting, however, so I shrugged and forced a chuckle. No more than the next guy. Who doesn't want to stay looking young? I changed the subject. Not that looking as great as you do isn't reward enough, but I never would have figured you for someone willing to drop that much money merely to be a sex bomb. Why?
Business, she said. I don't have the resources, team, or armament yet to land the big bids against the Saw and the others. That reduces me to tracking down the small stuff, and no one remembers the small stuff at contract time. Everyone expects anyone running my kind of business to be a scarred-up old warrior, so I went for the opposite look. They all remember me, and that's my ticket in. Plus, even after thousands of years of lessons to the contrary, I find that most men, and a surprisingly large number of women, reflexively assume that anyone who looks as sexy as I do is stupid, and that's a negotiating edge I can use. The Law is a security company now, but that's only a start. We're going to be much more.
The Law? I said, laughing a little.
The Local Area Weapons Corps, she said, not even smiling. My company.
How do Earl and the other guys at the Saw feel about that name?
They hate it. Think it's a slap at them.
Is it?
Of course, she said,
still not laughing at all, her face deadly serious. She leaned forward and looked straight into my eyes.
Now, what can I do for you?
For a moment, my mind jumped the business tracks and led me at high speed toward a contemplation of what this woman, this amazing body in front of me could do for me, and then I more fully appreciated the power of Lim's approach. I looked briefly away, regained focus, and this time when I gazed into her eyes, I made myself see only a person on the other side of a negotiation. You're right, I said. Your look is a powerful tool. I lost focus for a moment, and immediately I forgot about you as a person and instead thought only about your body as a sex object. I have to work to maintain my focus even now. She smiled and leaned back, waiting. In this building, I have no way to verify we're not being recorded, I said. If we are, however, and you end up working with me, you'll have at least as much to lose as I will, and probably more. Because your business provides services to corporations and governments. I honestly recommend you not record this. You can always decide later which of your team to tell.
This has been the Bane Free Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us at the heart of science fiction. Join us next week as we bring you part one of Jeremy Comeau's interview of editor Jamie Ibsen and a secret cast of authors to discuss the excellent anthology, Plausibly Deniable. After that, we'll have more One Jump Ahead by Mark L. Van Name, Part 53. Score by Ruth Judkowitz.